This is the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast with Gary Taylor.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast. Thank you for joining us again. It is most appreciated. And this time we are at Rex J. Woodgate Limited at Silverstone. And delighted to have Chris Woodgate here. Hello, Chris.
Hello to you. Welcome.
How long have you been here?
We've been here since 1991 now. So, yeah, what's the maths on that? 30 plus.
Yeah. 30 odd years.
Yeah.
And what's your specialism? Where are you at? What do you do with?
Well, primarily Aston's. We get involved with other marks. Generally, I'd like to think, because if we have a good Aston customer, client, whichever term you like to use, if they're happy with the Aston work, then more often than not, it'll be one of several in a collection, perhaps, and they'd like us to look at something else they have. So anything from MG to Maserati to Ferrari, but I'd say a good 75%+ is Aston, and mainly Feltham Aston. Older stuff, not the modern stuff,
right?
Which modern, I would say, is probably 70s onwards.
So is it the servicing, the restoring of cars?
Servicing, restoration, race preparation, from bare chassis right the way through, and we can manage the whole shebang. We don't paint, we don't trim, we don't panel beat, but pretty much everything else we do in-house. I think we are more towards the racing stuff. It just sort of highlights some of the work and gets a bit more challenging with, you know, development, and it's a, you know, bit more exciting to me. And a lot of my background was, before joining father of the company, was in the racing game as well. So I kind of like to think that maybe applied, although it was a few moons ago, apply some of the more modern racing preparation, development, if you like, to the classic cars as well, which may or may not give you the edge in certain circumstances.
It's interesting that you mentioned your father, because, well, he was known as Mr. Aston Martin in America, wasn't he? Wasn't he, Steve? Can you pick up on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if ever there was a title, you know, then that deserves to stay with Rex with it, Mr. Aston Martin, as he was known throughout the world, and particularly in America. And I know lots of American listeners will be nodding at this point, and they'll be thinking back to all sorts of stuff they've done with Rex over the years. So yeah, the word legend's overused, isn't it? But he was a legend, and Chris is a legend as well. So yeah. It's so lovely. I'd love coming to this, to come and see Chris. And I was just thinking, when you walk in and you see the way the workshop is, it's a kind of movie maker's dream. You know, if you see one of these period racing films, people would spend a lot of time to try and make it look like this, but this isn't fake. This is the real deal. The things hanging on the wall have been there since they were won and collected over the years, and it's the real thing. This is you walk in here and you're almost transported back to the days of the Feltham cars, where Rex was working on them. And that's why the business, I'm sure Chris will explain, has evolved that way. But that's fabulous. And to see Chris keeping the whole thing going, it's just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Can you tell us, Chris, more about Rex? He was born in 1926. And when I did a little bit of research, I think he was one of the Bevan boys. He was down the coal mines, appointed.
As a sort of six foot tour, you think, not a great choice, really. You'd soon put him on the front line, wouldn't you? You know, battering the Hun, right?
Battering the Hun,
then shoved down a Welsh mine somewhere at 3 foot high or whatever else. Dad had a brother who was RAF, and he died at 20. So just, you know, last couple of days, my daughter sat enthralled reading his diary.
Yeah, I think historically, I think if I remember rightly, it was a kind of like a lottery type selection, wasn't it? You were just
very much
at that point in the war. They didn't need, quite frankly, as many soldiers as I say, did other points in the war. So, but what they did need was coal, you know, no coal, no fuel, no sort of power. So people were just randomly selected. And as you say, a 6'2" individual down a mine that's 3 foot high is clearly not going to be much fun. No. And I think I would have rather took my chances with a rifle out in the front line than do that. And as I'm sure Rex probably felt the same way. But yeah, it's a bit of history, isn't it? It's another bit of unknown history for a lot of people. So Google it if you don't know what it is and find out all about it.
Well, unfortunately, it looks like he suffered an injury down the coal mine. And I think he had to leave, and then came as a mechanic at someone called Thompson and Taylor, and they built rally cars and world sports cars and raced at Brooklands or something like that.
I think they were involved with that. And again, a conversation I had fairly recently, and I think they were involved with some of the record breakers and also possibly the aircraft industry. Mm. But I'm a bit vague on that, I'm afraid.
Right.
Yeah, that's a long time ago. It's a bell, I seem to remember.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. And of course, Brooklands, all the way around the area where businesses doing, you know, everything from car preparation to, like you say, aeroplane parts and sometimes both. So, yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it, really?
There was a big crossover, wasn't there, between particularly the, you know, competition cars and the aero industry. And we see that, you know, right through.
Yeah.
Right through Aston's,
yeah,
you know, a lot of stuff that we've had to source, and you go to aircraft spare companies because that's where the quality was. You know, whether it be a light or a switch or a bulb holder. Or
thinking of those else. Fuel taps, which are
exactly that. Aren't they? Yeah, which spookily they were attached with big Aston name John Wyatt, and if you look at an original GT40 and look over the driver's right shoulder, you'll see an identical fuel tap on a GT40 as you see on a DB3S or R1 or R2.
Yeah.
So that's something he probably, you know, sourced and reliable.
Exactly. And really well made, right?
Through his other,
well engineered
attachments.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's another thing most people don't realise is that, you know, when you've got a country at war and it gears up to make things, it gathers momentum, and you end up with towards the end of a conflict, you end up with more than you need, so you end up with surplus.
It would be a huge surplus.
And it would have been, right, we need a tap or a switch, well, nip down the army surplus store and buy some then. Exactly. And it had been everywhere around Feltham, and there'd been so much stuff available for next to nothing, including tins of paint. I know some of our paint allegedly was ex-MOD paint, you know, in the early days, so it all makes sense, doesn't it, really?
Sure.
I noticed that during his early car mechanic career, he met Stirling Moss, and it seemed quite interesting that he showed me just moments ago as we were setting up for the podcast. He said, "Oh, I found my dad's CV," and he read it out. And the first thing we saw at the very top was mechanic to Stirling Moss. So that's going to catch your eye for an employer, isn't it?
Well, that was right at the beginning of Stirling, wasn't it?
Yeah, Stirling was in Cooper 500s, I think, at the time, which was
1949, it said, didn't it? So,
So, you know, Stirling was a proper youngster then.
And was it Stirling's dad that asked Rex to come and work for him as a mechanic? Was that, if I remember rightly, something like that?
I would have thought so. I think he was sort of, you know, managing the show for the youngster at the time. So,
yeah
I don't really know how their paths crossed.
Certainly a nice thing to have happened, isn't it? You know, it was pretty amazing for both of them, I guess.
And obviously their paths crossed throughout, you know, the Aston relationship.
And then that then led Rex to then come and work for Aston Martin itself. Is that right?
Yeah, there were a few other sort of bumps in the road, a few other appointments. One I spoke to with a great guy around the corner, super duper fella. Jaguar specialist, is not dissimilar position to Rex. John Pearson, who has sons Gary and John Pearson. Gary, phenomenal driver, phenomenal preparer of Jaguars, amongst other things. And I was only speaking to his dad, John, the other day, John Sr., and he'd seen a picture somewhere of Rex in a Ferrari. And I said, well, that can only be when he worked for Leslie Hawthorne at TT Motors, which was, of course, Mike Hawthorne's father. And and I tied that up when I looked at the CV the other day, because it said, look, compared Ferraris, and then in brackets, we beat the works cars. So he obviously did a decent job of it.
Yeah.
Bless him.
Wow.
So yeah, there was an involvement there, TT Garage, a reasonable involvement, I believe, at HWM's. That was the kind of beginning of his Aston journey.
Yeah. So when we've talked in previous podcasts about Feltham, for many of us, none of us really fully understood what Feltham really meant for Aston Martin. But post-war, that's where the company had moved to Hanworth Air Park. And at Hanworth Air Park was initially the production building for DB2, but also significantly, it was where engineering and racing were based.
Yeah.
And that's where your dad worked, isn't it? In the racing side of it. And
sure. Yeah. Involved with the racing department and also, you know, racing was seasonal, and exactly the same situation I was with many, many years later when I was at Van Diemen's, who worked for the racing department. When the racing department's off season, you go into production.
Yeah.
So Rex went into production, and he was responsible for majority builds of the production DB3Ss. Such a huge part of what he did and what we do. And as we discussed earlier, whilst drooling over a lovely example in the workshop, to me, it's the ultimate Aston in appearance and performance. It's
just, and those cars are the cars that he built originally, basically.
Indeed, yeah. Of which, you know, I haven't been through the register and counted them, but I'd say I wouldn't be surprised if we had 50% of them through the workshop one way or another.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Very, very fortunate. They're just such wonderful cars.
And cars you can say as a family you've known for, well, from new.
Like a lot of them,
70 years, basically, between yourself and Rex. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Yeah. So 31 of them.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, the most iconic models of our history books, really. And then, of course, you've got the cars that followed DBR1 and even DBR4 and the other DBR2 and DBR3. They're all amazing cars, aren't they? And that's the cars we're talking about, isn't it? That's what your dad
built. When they started to talk about and the sort of publicity, I think the big phrase then was we'll race on Sunday and sell on Monday.
Yeah.
The 3S was a big part of that. And of course, there was an awful lot of them racing, both works and privately owned cars in the 50s. So, you know, an iconic picture on a poster. And then, of course, when it came to the R1, which was so elegant, and of course the victory at Le Mans was a massive booster for that. And then of course it went, you know, that's, as you say, when people think Aston, you think R1, and you know, everybody's David Brown sat on the wing and Cal Shelby, and it's
I always try
to stuck in your memory, isn't it?
Exactly. And you know, other brands have won Le Mans more times than we have, but it's the way it was done, and against all odds, wasn't it? We were a very different setup to the bigger names, or the other big names that turned up with big purpose-built trucks and transporters. And with Aston, there was always that kind of underdog and British bulldog spirit, wasn't it? So there'd be a bunch of second-hand vehicles painted dark green that all turn up, and everybody mucked in. The drivers and the mechanics were all sort of friends, etc. And that's why I think the effort it took to win meant so much, probably more, didn't it, to those involved. And
it was almost an afterthought, I'm led to believe, was when they had success, didn't they, beforehand?
I mean, we've
got a chance of this.
Yeah.
And I think the intention was to go for the championship rather than the Le Mans victory.
Yeah. Well, you know,
wanted to do well.
Yeah, different things you read.
My understanding was that was part of the championship.
I think the boils down to is David Brown was starting to get sort of tired of the whole thing, because he was pouring money in, most of it his own money.
Well, when did R1 kick off? 56, 57. Yeah. So it wasn't a...
Like 59, it was... No,
it had been, you know, developed, obviously, over a period of time, but effectively the car was a couple of years... 3 years old.
Exactly,
It wasn't fresh out of the box.
No, and if you look at the competition, the Ferraris were running big engine cars, and, you know, it was like going to a gunfight with a knife, wasn't it, really? So the only way we could stand a chance of winning was really the tactics and good teamwork, and obviously the cars being bang on. But to think that Rex was part of it, and just amazing, you know, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, that was because that was a real sort of the tortoise and the hare job, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Sent Sterling out.
Yeah,
to wear them out. Full beans, knowing that the car was likely to break, but drag the other ones with him and break them as well.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Went absolutely to plan.
Yeah. And on a Monday morning, I dare say all the dealerships had people flooded in to buy cars because that literally was the name of the game. And they reckon that the reason why manufacturers would always do Le Mans, even if nothing else, is because it's the all eyes were on it and it sold cars. So if you were making cars that looked anything like the ones you were racing, then you sell them basically. And I think for me, the big thing to anyone that's listening that is interested in Astons but doesn't know that much about the early cars is don't overlook the 1950s. Don't overlook the Feltham cars, because the cars that you see, the DB2, the 2.4, the Mark III, those were the road-going cars you could buy, but they were really closely related with the racing cars that were actually racing in front of you. And odds are, you know, members of the team drove there in those cars and drove back again. And,
well, it was interesting that, Chris, you said earlier that the 3S that we saw out there, you could use that as a road car. You could actually drive that.
Yeah.
Because it was development from those road cars.
Phenomenal.
Whereas
the
DBR1 just took it perhaps a bit more racy forward and not so...
In my opinion, I think so, yeah. They were really sort of, you know, the race cars were starting to pull away from what I would call a sports racing car to a purpose-built race. Mm. So, you know, that's the way things were going.
Yeah.
To remain competitive, they had to sort of take away a bit of the creature comforts disappeared slightly. They were going for things that were lighter, and obviously there was, you know, chassis stiffness and, you know, lack of synchro meshes and all that sort of thing. Whereas, you know, the 3S, you said Feltham cars, you look at the twos and the 2.4s and actually the Mark III to a degree, the engine, the gearbox was the same as the DB3S.
Yeah.
And even the six-cylinder engine that went into the DBR1, which was the RB6 300 engine, bore stroke, it was the same engine with an aluminium block as opposed to cast iron, dry sump, but it was effectively the same engine, you know.
Yeah. It is incredible the link between these racing cars that were very successful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And leading up to the Le Mans victory were very much based on the road cars.
Mm. I think one of the fascinating things for me when I looked at DBR4, so DBR4 is the F1 car that was built 1960. And when I read into the story that some of the components were sort of loosely based on what they were engineering for the road cars and the track cars. So basically certain bits of those cars you'd find in the road going customer cars and the sports cars and effectively F1 cars. I mean, that's pretty amazing stuff, isn't it, really?
Stuff did cross out.
You could line all three cars up and there'd be bits that were similar.
I've got a picture somewhere, Nassau Speed Week in the Bahamas, and there's a picture of Rex and a couple of chums with their heads underneath a Mark III, which was clearly in the public car park.
Yeah.
And the Mark III we discussed earlier, which was the car that still belongs to the Gross family. John Gross, who sadly died, which was belonged to his father, which my dad looked after in Sebring and at Nassau in 57, 58. And they were pilfering stuff off a road car in the car park because clearly they'd broken something on track.
Probably so, borrow you a bit from it.
When you say stuff crosses over,
it really did.
That is the case.
Yeah.
So
anyone jumped in it without one, I'm sure the customer would have known who owned it. But yeah, it is amazing to think you could do that, isn't it? You know. And the other story I'd heard as well was the Mark III grill was developed for the DB3S grill. So the DB3S grill came first, and then that inspired the guys at Feltham to give the car a nose job, and that's what led to the Mark III looking the way it does. I met a chap a few years back, and he was a retired Feltham draftsman, and he was a junior draftsman, and apparently they had a competition in the office to make up a drawing for a suggestion for a new front end, and he put his in, and apparently that was the one that they pulled out the heap and said that's the one we're going to go with. So whether that's true,
was that the Mark III or was that the Mark
III? Yeah, the Mark III. Yeah, I dare say the DB as well was we looked on Google Images and looked at all the greatest hits. But you know, to be fair, that we in a funny kind of way, that's what we do. We do look back at the past and we look for ideas and then we modernise them and tweak them and,
well, you know, say,
we don't copy them, but they inspire them.
You know,
yeah.
If you squint, you might just pick up there's a little bit of, you know, rear haunch or grill or something. That
just a little nod.
Just gives you a little kickback.
Yeah. But yeah, what a story, isn't it? Amazing. And then, of course, Rex then ended up in America, didn't he? So he went from the factory, ended up going to America to effectively set up what became Aston Martin North America.
Well, he was over there with the racing department first. I'm fairly certain what instigated that was the DVR2s couldn't run here because of the engine size. They put a capacity restriction on the sports cars. So they thought it might be an idea whether this was the sort of first bit of promotion of the brand in the US. He took an R2 over, which they raced in the sports car championship.
And then your dad ended up being asked to go and live there and move you guys out there. And
yeah, the story was he went over in 58 for 6 months. got involved. There was saying the dealership who he tied up there was in New York.
I've got it written down as J.S. Inskips.
J.S. Inskips. That's right. Yeah. So there was a connection there. Aston's, I guess, just followed up with their sort of promotion of the brand to the point where they said, we need someone, you know, doing this properly, importer, distributor, call it what you will.
Mm-hmm. Because I think there was a number of independent importers over there, and I think Rex suggested,
I guess,
bringing
we wanted to
we need to bring it all together to get control over
it. I mean, I interviewed Rex a few years back, and it was amazing to hear the story. And he said, you know, he'd get a phone call from somebody, and you know, somebody would phone up and say, I want to buy an Aston Martin. And the first question was, well, where do you live? And it'd be Pennsylvania or somewhere, wherever it was. And he'd get the kind of book out and see where the nearest sports car dealership was. Because if there wasn't an Aston dealer, he needed to find someone who could look after it. And that was all part of the kind of process, wasn't it? Your dad would kind of get the car on order and then sort of follow it through to being delivered and make sure that whoever was local was going to be able to look after it. I mean, it was just really kind of forging ahead and developing what is now our biggest market in the world, you know, from scratch, and using a kind of borrowed corner of a car showroom to base himself. The other story that your mum told me was when she came over on the Queen Mary, I believe.
Yeah.
So your dad sort of said, right, pack yourself up and come over. And she kind of literally put all her trunks and things onto the Queen Mary, and then he met her at the
other end. Trunk in the workshop.
I thought I spotted it earlier. I wondered if that was
Cunard label on it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that's a piece of history in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he told me that he
had the right size for shipping a cylinder head.
And he told me your dad was friends with a policeman in New York, and he said, you'll never get her off it will take hours to get her off the boat, so I'll come with you and help you get her through the crowd. And I think it was either your mum or your dad or both of them that told me the story. And he kind of turned up in a squad car, and he's kind of his friend, the policeman, like pushed his way through the crowd and kind of blew his whistle or whatever, and then kind of helped her off the boat and back towards.
Oh, that's a new one on this.
We'll have to find that
nice story.
It's a lovely. Again, you could just close your eyes and imagine it, can't you? It
doesn't fantastic. Sound dissimilar to when I took the kids to Disney many years ago. And of course, having been born in Philadelphia, I've still got my American passport.
Right.
So, you know, you can imagine the back and forth queues of people at immigration in Orlando. And I whipped out the American passport. Enormous American fella dragged me to one side and said, welcome home, sir. Dragged me and the family to the front of the queue. And I thought, oh, that's quite good.
That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And now another story I remember you telling me, and one of my favorite stories, I think, is tell us about show and tell day at school.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's broadcastable.
Oh, yeah. I think your words to me were most kids bring a rabbit in or something, you know. Yeah. So I think your friend
rabbit if they were really showing off.
If they're really showing off. But, so, you know, the sort of thing, you're at school, the teacher says, right, everybody bring something in from home tomorrow and tell us a story about it. Yeah. And what did your dad bring in?
Well, he bought the DV5 James Bond car. Yeah.
The gold finger car.
That was
in the playground.
Yeah, that was it. Marple Town junior high school.
It was
actually for my brother, not for me. So
okay.
I can't take all.
But this is in America then, is it?
In America, yeah. That's yeah, brother was born there as well. He was born in New York, but we were at school in the Philadelphia area. And it happened to be a time when one of the bomb cars, because there was a few of them filming, etc.
And, you know, in a way, in this conversation already, we've already talked about two of the biggest things in our entire history, you know, the cars that won Le Mans and all the racing success before and after. And then James Bond, I mean, they're literally the two biggest things in the history.
Well, it's interesting. If you had to define key moments in Aston Martin history, I think you would always say Le Mans racing, winning Le Mans, and James Bond.
Definitely.
Yeah. And that's in the middle of all of it.
Your family, your father was in the thick of it.
And at that point, selling brand new DB5s. I mean, that was literally what you were doing, wasn't it? It was selling DB5s. And then, of course, all the struggles, but later on in the 70s, we're trying to get the DBS and the DBS V8 in because of the emission hoops he had to jump through. And I mean, and even coming up, but he told me that he kept writing to the factory and saying, we need wood veneer dashboards like a Rolls Royce has, and we need a convertible. And they kept sort of rejecting it. And then eventually he got so frustrated, he got a local artist and basically drew a picture of a car without a roof.
Sketches,
I mean, it's just amazing, isn't it? Yeah. And then they did listen to him, and we came out with the V8 Volante and the Oscar India updates that included a wood dashboard.
That was the market.
They wanted a convertible.
Rex knew what they wanted. Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
And he was doing, he was called like Mr. Aston Martin America because he was this, what, 6 foot two, would you say he was?
Yeah.
Six foot two. The Terry Thomas moustache, was it?
Big handlebar moustache.
Very much an Englishman.
The reason he was called Mr. Aston Martin was because anybody that owned an Aston Martin or was interested in him would know Rex, because he was the contact with the outside world in America, wasn't he? He was the face of Aston Martin.
I got the impression that he was, kind of personally involved with most of the owners, which fair, to see an Aston over there was quite a rare thing. As I was a youngster growing up, you'd see one and it was a big celebration.
I saw an advert in your workshop. It was an American advert, and they really promoted the hand-built side of things, didn't they? That was the big thing, the perfect machine built by hand. I tell you something, Chris, I mean, we had a look around there. If money's ever tight for you, you could open it up as a museum and charge admission, because you go around and there's stuff everywhere, isn't it?
It really is.
It's amazing. I saw that poster up there for the American V8s.
I mean,
I know the one, the hand-built, proud Englishman.
That's it.
I think that went in the Wall Street Journal. New York Times.
Serious stuff, isn't it?
Not sure if the bowl hats scouring about the place would sit well with me. But we're not big on self-promotion. We just kind of let the job speak for itself here. We don't really advertise as a rule. And, if people do come in and go, oh, God, didn't know all this was here. That's
the idea.
People that know. I always think,
right,
the people that matter know.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we don't have to crow.
No, and we're talking your specialist thing, obviously, the race cars, of which, even if you add them all together, there aren't that many, because there never were that many in the first place. But if you've got one, they will know you or know of you. And when the cars change hands, they often still come back to you because the new owner follows it.
That's a really nice thing that I'm sort of super proud of.
Mm.
Him saying not crowing.
Yeah.
is when a car changes hands and the car stays with us.
Yeah.
It's almost like the car is more ours than the owners.
Yeah.
We're all custodians.
Yeah.
But they ask us about the car and we can go through it. Drives my wife mad. Where shall I file this car? Because there's the same car has got, three or four different owners and you're moving it as it changes hands. There's, cuck. Do it with the car. The car's the star.
Yeah.
The car's the star.
Always. Yes. Not the owner, bless them, whoever they are, lovely people, but it's the car, isn't it?
And no, we're not going to do that to the car. You want sat nav or thing, don't buy it.
Did you
don't
ever
buy get a Felton Aston?
Yeah. Do you ever get approached by someone who says, I want to do this? And you think, we're not doing that. And I politely recommend you don't do it, sir.
Well, madam. Yeah. It's just,
Well, sometimes
we said old school earlier.
A
DB2 doesn't want air conditioning and sat nav and, you know, power steering. But, you know, it's a bit hard in the supermarket. Well, what are you doing in the supermarket?
Yeah.
You know, it's
they're to be enjoyed as they are.
And, that's what they are. They're charming. So, you know, why did you buy a Feltham Aston? You don't want it.
Is there any gentle enhancements that you could introduce to a Feltham car? Perhaps just some modern techniques,
Speed I'm all for.
Speed you're
particularly if you're going to go, you know, if you're going to go race. Let's talk about power and reliability.
If you can do like period.
That can be improved.
Period mods as well. That's all acceptable, isn't it?
I'm probably being a bit facetious. If somebody wants power steering and that means they're going to use the car and enjoy it, then it's doable.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, I don't like power steering and I don't like servos. You know, do some weights and push the pedal a bit harder. You know, that's me. And if somebody wants something else, I'm all ears, but they need to justify it to me, really.
Okay.
I'm not a big concourse fan. And there's a lot of a lot of polishing and shining and this and that.
Oh,
and
I'm like, it's just really? My personal passion. But these polishing contests, I just can't deal with.
If a lot of people get a lot of joy out of it, and fair play to them, that's great. And we were heavily involved with a DB3S that did very, very well at Pebble Beach. And that was quite an interesting thing because it wasn't the polishing aspect. It was the sourcing the correct. You know, the dashboard needed to be like this and the gauges were not that way around. And were they black bezel? Were they chrome bezels? Once I switched there, you know, let's get this as right as we can. Mm. And, you know, you come to a point where you think, you know, I just don't know. And again, we touched on it earlier. You've got to take a snapshot because a lot of this stuff changed. So you say, this is the car correct on that day in 19 Bow and Arrow when it was racing it. You know, Silverstone Express Trophy or whatever else.
So you're rebuilding a snapshot in time, aren't you, really?
Exactly that.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that was interesting to be given to help someone who was that enthusiastic about going to Pebble Beach with a lovely car. And if we're going to go, let's really try and do something with it.
Yeah.
And the car had success.
Yeah.
And that was quite proud because that's not something that I'm a massive fan of. I'd be running around the track and saying, you know, he went 4 seconds quicker than he went last year. Yeah. We've achieved something.
Yeah.
When was the last time you were on a track?
Me?
Yeah.
Silverstone Classic or Silverstone Festival.
Festival now.
Last year.
Last year.
In the DB Mark III, which we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
The X-John Gross car.
And also you very kindly helped us out with the 110 car parade last year.
Yeah.
In fact, Gary, you drove A3.
A3, yeah.
So Gary drove A3, you drove a DB3S.
I drove a DB3S, yeah.
And you always truly tried to drive a DB5, a Goldfinger car, about stuffing it into the nearest Armco. But yeah, so all three of us were there on that one. But yeah, I mean, that was both of you, actually. I mean, got much better deal than I had because they were proper sort of iconic original cars. I was very fortunate to be in a very nice continuation car, which is also arguably iconic as well. But yeah, it's a good day. That was a bit hot, wasn't it? But
it was very toasty.
I think it was one of the hottest days of the year because it was. Because the next day it was like chucked down the rain, didn't it?
It did. Yeah, it did, didn't it? Yeah. It was the day before, so it was on the practice day, wasn't it? Friday before the.
That's right.
Before the qualifying day of the British Grand Prix.
To drive around the circuit in an absolutely wonderful car. And the fellow who asked me to do it, who looks after an amazing collection, was in an Aston himself and positively encouraged misbehaving with tyre smoke. So, a bit of that as well, which the crowds which were parted for us as we came through from the middle of the circuit back to the factory was very exciting.
It's amazing, wasn't it?
There was a bit of Dunlop.
Yeah.
Rear Dunlops required after that exercise.
A bit more rubber on the track.
All part of the fun.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it?
Really, really good fun.
Growing the passion, sharing the stories. The Aston Martin Heritage Podcast.
Because so the family returned back to the UK in 1978.
78. So they went for 6 months and stayed for 20 years.
Right. Yeah. What did he do when he came back?
Well, that was kind of one of several sketchy periods for AM or AML as it became. And my understanding was there was no longer a position for him in the US. There was a position offered in engineering to Rex back at Newport Pagnell.
Mm.
So that's what happened. We moved back. And not sure he ever really, really took to. I think one of the best things about that time was he seemed to build up a great relationship with MVG, with Victor Gauntlett. So he was involved with not just the Aston side of things, but also Pace Petroleum and also Tickford.
Yes.
So he was got to know very well the likes of David Orchard and Steve Hallam, engineering guys who were, in fact, the first house I lived in was Steve and David's house where Rex was living while we were looking for property. Mum hadn't come over yet, so I came over with Dad and went into school. That lasted for a while, and then Dad was doing some, he was doing a lot of test driving. It was some of the Tickford stuff they were involved with XJS. I think they'd done a special engine for that. Was it the introduction of the 3.8?
Because Tickford was really like in a consultancy
business. They were. They were doing all sorts of funny stuff. So he was heavily involved with them, and he was driving the Pace six-wheeled Range Rover around sponsored the Rally Championship. So he's off to the Isle of Man with the Range Rover and the caravan on the back. Of course, most of the time with Mum as well. So, you know, they were having a bit of fun and they were earning. You know, and I think he pretty much decided that the factory thing wasn't working out, so there were other things to get involved with, which were mainly instigated through Victor Gauntlett, and until eventually he kind of bit the bullet and started off on his own, which was from the outbuildings at the house at Blisworth, not far from here, where he was kind of decided we'll go it alone, which was mainly a machine shop and an engine shop, and he was. Some Astons, but by no means exclusively Astons. He did a lot of Maserati stuff. Of course, there's a connection there as well, because Richard Mallett was an apprentice at Newport Pagnell.
I didn't know.
As with his brother Ray.
Yeah, I would say Ray was, wasn't he?
But we saw a bit of Ray, but that, as I went in, that was kind of early 80s, and I think Ray was kind of decided he was going to be doing his own thing there. So he opened his first shop and then he went on to enormous things. It's just, as we know, with the group's huge involvement with Group C Astons and Acura Cars and Touring Car Championships with Nissans and Chevrolet, and now has a huge facility over at Wellingborough and doing all sorts of funny stuff. And so Ray drove for us in the DVR2 when we ran that 89, I think,
right,
which was a sports car championship, very early days of historic racing. And we did a round at the Nürburgring and won by a mile. There was two rounds at Silverstone, as I recall, and we won the first race. And I think there were a few people that were a little bit bent out of shape. They thought either the car was too quick or the driver was too quick or both. So it was suggested that we should do a pit stop. So I remember Ray went storming off into the lead and then came down the pit lane. And dear Rex went and fished his handkerchief out of the front grill as if there'd been some kind of debris they picked up and hung around for 20 seconds or something, and then sent him back out. I think he got back up to second. So I think from memory, we won on aggregate anyway. So the people that were upset were still upset. There we are.
So great, great. Again, this incestual business of Astons and racing cars, and that was the involvement with Mallox, say Richard Ray, and dear old Arthur, who's no longer with us, who was a real character. Yeah, really clever guy, but from a practical point of view, didn't struggle, I think, sometimes to get his desires to materialize, but yeah. But the brain was phenomenal. That was me from school whilst Dad was kicking off on his own.
So that was you from school, and here you are now. You've been here since 1991.
Yeah. There was a little space between when I decided Mallox had probably seen out what I could do there and fancied a different challenge and maybe getting away from the area. So I looked at Formula Fords, and I'd had interviews with both Quest and Van Diemen's, and that was through a lovely lady called Val Attaway, who had a company called Formula Services, and she was just a darling, and she'd arrange interviews and this, that, and the other. They sponsored races, and she looked after young fellas like me that wanted to do stuff and get involved with the racing. So anyway, I opted for the Van Diemen route. So I was up in Norfolk for a couple of years. That was sort of 85, 86. Did a couple of years on the works team up there with Ford 1600s. And then, so a few years had passed. Dad was getting more and more inquiries about work, both engine work and also chassis work, which he was beginning to sub out and wasn't necessarily happy with what he was getting back from the chassis people, because there wasn't the facility to do chassis work from home. Was the engines and machine shop?
Was this all done under the Rex J. Woodgate Limited name?
Yes. Yeah. He was literally just operating under his own name.
Yeah.
So it was he suggested we were on much better terms at that point. A couple of years had passed, and he thought it might be a good idea. Did I want to come back and get involved with something?
Mm.
So, yeah, that's what I did. And that's when we got the first unit, which was not this one here. We had one actually at the Grove behind, which was a lot smaller, which we did purely for chassis work. So that was 88, 89. I'd say we went in there. And then 91, he decided to sell up at Blisworth, and we put everything here. So engines, machine shop, and chassis, all in this unit, which, as you say, that was 91.
Okay. And where do you see? So you're concentrating on Feltham cars. Is that because you wanted to, or was that the way you felt the market was? There was a historical element to that. I say Feltham, I'm including the racing cars as well, DB3Ss and things.
I think it's probably much case to stick with what you know. We were doing more and more Feltons, and if you know your way around, and they're very quirky.
Yeah.
Engines are quite quirky. So if you know them, then I think you can give a better service, and you're turning more stuff over, and you can give better value as well.
Mm.
So I think that was really the objective there, was to do a proper job for a fair price.
Where do you see the future going?
I don't know whether aspirations is the right word, but very much concentrate on the quality rather than the quantity.
Yeah.
And I don't think you'll see a right lot different here from what you would have seen 20 years ago. Mm. You know, we're a handful of keen lads doing what I'd like to think is a proper job. Going back to no aspirations to employ 20 people and have a big factory. It's just kind of not.
Well, as you say, the cars keep coming back to you, even though the owners change, and if you maintain the quality, not chasing the quality.
Well, it was a classic, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It works perfectly as it is, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's great. It still puts a smile on my face. So, you know, let's keep it that way. Like Steve says, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
We're very lucky. We can, to a degree, we pick and choose. Our customers work for some really wonderful guys and some clever, some high flyers, and that to be involved with those people,
go back to what I said earlier, the people that know, and if they think you're doing a good job and they've got a choice of anywhere in the world they could send their cars, if they're going to send them to me, then that makes me very proud.
Well, that's very good. So to wrap up, I mean, we're recording this on a wet, miserable, grey day. Looking for the year ahead, are we going to see you in a Feltham car racing on a sunnier day? What's your racing plans, if any, this year?
Like to be out. In fact, I've discussed it with another guy who races a Mark III only a few days ago. I'd like to be out in Gross Mark III again, whether that be at Silverstone Festival or somewhere else. Who knows? Unfortunately, I haven't got an Aston that I race myself, but I've got a lovely little Elva Courier, and I'm desperate to get that back together again because that's in bits, and have some fun with that.
Yeah.
You know, a few years gone back, I've been really, really fortunate to share some wonderful cars, DB3, DB3Ss with guys. Unfortunately, that's not the case at the moment. I haven't got anyone running that needs a safe second driver. Until the ticket comes in and I can buy a 3S for myself, then that's not going to happen. I'll stick with my little Elva.
All right.
Or indeed my Malik, because I got a little Malik as well. Oh, but that's something that needs a bit more care with, because it weighs nothing and it's got a little Ford twin cam in it. So that's quite a rattle.
It's quite fun.
It's fun, but last time I went out in the wet, I did scare myself a little bit. Maybe I'm getting a bit too old for it. I need some brave pills.
well, stay intact, because I think they need you here, don't they, to run this brilliant business. I think we'll wrap up the podcast here now. Chris, thank you very much for your reflections and insight. I much appreciate your
time. Thank you. No, it's been great fun.
And Steve, thank you for your input as well.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Great to see Steve, as always.
Puts a smile on my face when they walk in there every time. So, yeah, it's lovely to see Chris.
You're both welcome anytime.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, yeah.
Thank you.
Discover more about the story of Aston Martin, the cars, the people, the history, with the Aston Martin Heritage Trust. You're always welcome to visit us at our museum in Oxfordshire, so find out more via amht.org.uk.